War Council. On the flight from Vroengard to Urabain, Saphira did not have to battle her way through a storm, and was fortunate enough to have a tailwind to speed her progress. For the Eldenari told her where to find the fast-moving stream of air, which they said blew nearly every day of the year. Also, the Eldenari fed her a constant supply of energy, so she never flagged or grew tired. As a result, the city first came into sight on the horizon a mere 2 days after they departed the island. Twice during the trip, when the sun was at its brightest, Aragorn thought he glimpsed the entrance to the pocket of space where the Eldunari floated hidden behind Saphira. It appeared as a single dark point, so small that he could not keep his eyes fixed upon it for more than a second. At first he assumed it was a mote of dust, but then he noticed that the point never varied in its distance from Saphira. And when he saw it, it was always in the same place. As they flew, the dragons had, through Umaroth, poured memory after memory into Aragorn and Saphira, a cascade of experiences. Battles won and battles lost, loves, hates, spells, events witnessed throughout the land, regrets, realizations, and ponderings concerning the workings of the world. The dragons possessed thousands of years of knowledge, and they seemed driven to share every last bit. "It's too much," Aragorn had protested. "We can't remember it all, much less understand it."
"No," said Umaroth, "but you can remember some. And it may be that some will be what you need to defeat Galbatorix. Now, let us continue."
The torrent of information was overwhelming. At times Aragorn felt as if he was forgetting who he was, for the dragon's memories far outnumbered his own. When that happened, he would separate his mind from theirs and repeat his true name to himself until he again felt secure in his identity. The things he and Saphira learned amazed and troubled him, and oftentimes caused him to question his own beliefs. But he never had time to dwell on such thoughts, for there was always another memory to take their place. It would, he knew, take him years to begin to make sense of what the dragons were showing them. The more he learned about the dragons, the more he regarded them with awe. Those who had lived for hundreds of years were strange in their ways of thinking, and the oldest were as different from Gleyda and Saphira as Gleyda and Saphira were from the Fanghur in the Beor Mountains. Interacting with these elders was confusing and unsettling. They made jumps, associations, and comparisons that seemed meaningless, but that Aragorn knew made sense at some deep level. He was rarely able to figure out what they were trying to say, and the ancient dragons did not deign to explain themselves in terms that he could understand. After a while, he realized that they couldn't express themselves in any other way. Over the centuries, their minds had changed. What was simple and straightforward for him often seemed complicated for them, and the same was true in reverse. Listening to their thoughts, he felt, must be like listening to the thoughts of a god. When he made that particular observation, Saphira snorted and said to him,
"There is a difference."
"What?"
"Unlike gods, we take part in the events of the world."
"Perhaps the gods choose to act without being seen."
"Then what good are they?"
"You believe that dragons are better than gods?" he asked, amused.
"When we are fully grown, yes. What creature is greater than us? Even Galbatorix depends upon us for his strength."
"What of the Nithwal?" she sniffed.
"We can swim, but they cannot fly."
The very oldest of the Eldunari, a dragon by the name of Valdur, which meant ruler in the ancient language, spoke to them directly only once. From him they received a vision of beams of light turning into waves of sand, as well as a disconcerting sense that everything that seemed solid was mostly empty space. Then Valdur showed them a nest of sleeping starlings, and Aragorn could feel their dreams flickering in their minds, fast as the blink of an eye. At first, Valdur's emotion was one of contempt. The starlings' dreams seemed tiny, petty, and inconsequential. But then his mood changed and became warm and sympathetic, and even the smallest of the starling's concerns grew in importance until it seemed equal to the worries of kings. Valda lingered over the vision, as if to make sure that Aragorn and Saphira would remember it amid all the other memories. Yet neither of them was certain what the dragon was trying to say, and Valda refused to explain himself further. When at last Urabain came into view, the Eldunari ceased sharing their memories with Aragorn and Saphira, and Umaroth said,
"Now you would be best served by studying the lair of our foe."
This they did, as Saphira descended toward the ground over the course of many leagues. What they saw did not encourage either of them, nor did their moods improve when Gleda said,
"Calbatorix has built much since he drove us from this place. The walls were not so thick nor so tall in our day."
To which Umaroth added,
"Nor was Illyria this heavily fortified during the war between our kind and the elves. The traitor has burrowed deep and piled a mountain of stone about his hole. He will not come out of his own accord, I think. He is like a badger who has retreated into his den and who will bloody the nose of anyone who tries to dig him out."
A mile southwest from the wall shelf and the city beneath lay the Varden's camp. It was significantly larger than Aragorn remembered, which puzzled him until he realized that Queen Islanzadi and her army must have finally joined forces with the Varden. He gave a small sigh of relief. Even Galbatorix was wary of the might of the elves. When he and Saphira were a league or so from the tents, the Eldunari helped Aragorn extend the range of his thoughts until he was able to feel the minds of the men, dwarves, elves, and Urgals gathered within the camp. His touch was too light for anyone to notice, unless they were deliberately watching for it, and the moment he located the distinctive strain of wild music that marked Blodgarm's thoughts, he narrowed his focus to the elf alone.
"Blodgarm," he said, "it is I, Aragorn."
The more formal phrasing seemed natural to him, after so long spent reliving experiences from ages past.
"Shadeslayer, are you safe? Your mind feels most strange. Is Saphira with you? Is she hurt? Has something happened to Gleda?"
"They are both well, as am I."
"Then..."
Blodgarm's confusion was evident. Cutting him off, Aragorn said,
"We're not far, but I've hidden us from sight for the time being. Is the illusion of Saphira and me still visible to those below?"
"Yes, Shadeslayer. We have Saphira circling the tents a mile above. Sometimes we hide her in a bank of clouds, or we make it seem as if you and she have gone off on patrol. But we dare not let Galbatorix think you've left for long. We will make your images fly away now, so that you may rejoin us without arousing suspicion."
"No, rather wait and maintain your spells for a while longer."
"Shadeslayer?
We are not returning directly to the camp."
Aragorn glanced at the ground.
"There's a small hill, perhaps 2 miles to the southeast. Do you know it?"
"Yes, I can see it."
"Saphira will land behind it. Have Arya, Oric, Jormunda, Roran, Queen Islanzadi, and King Orin join us there. But make sure they do not leave the camp all at once. If you could help hide them, that would be best. You should come as well."
"As you wish. Shadeslayer, what did you find on..."
"No, do not ask me. It would be dangerous to think of it here. Come, and I will tell you. But I do not want to blare the answer where others might be listening."
"I understand. We will meet with you as quickly as we can, but it may take some time to stagger our departures correctly."
"Of course. I trust you'll do what's best."
Aragorn severed their connection and leaned back in the saddle. He smiled slightly as he imagined Blodgarm's expression when he learned of the Eldunari. With a whirl of wind, Saphira landed in the hollow by the base of the hill, startling a flock of nearby sheep who scurried away
while uttering plaintive bleats. As she folded her wings, Sephira looked after the sheep and said,
"It would be easy to catch them, since they cannot see me."
She licked her chops. "Yes, but where would be the sport in that?" Aragorn asked, loosening the straps around his legs.
"Sport does not fill your belly."
"No, but then you aren't hungry, are you?" The energy from the Eldunari, though insubstantial, had suppressed her desire to eat. She released a great amount of air in what seemed to be a sigh.
"No, not really."
While they waited, Aragorn stretched his sore limbs, then ate a light lunch from what remained of his provisions. He knew that Sephira was sprawled her full, sinuous length on the ground next to him, though he could not see her. Her presence was betrayed only by the shadowed impression her body left upon the flattened stalks of grass, like a strangely shaped hollow. He was not sure why, but the sight amused him. As he ate, he gazed out at the pleasant fields around the hill, watching the stir of air in the stalks of wheat and barley. Long, low walls of piled stone separated the fields. It must have taken the local farmers hundreds of years to dig so many stones out of the ground. "At least that wasn't a problem we had in Palancar Valley," he thought. A moment later, one of the dragon's memories returned to him, and he knew exactly how old the stone walls were. They dated to the time when humans had come to live in the ruins of Illyria, after the elves had defeated King Palancar's warriors. He could see, as if he had been there, lines of men, women, and children combing over freshly tilled fields and carrying the rocks they found over to where the walls would be. After a time, Aragorn allowed the memory to fade away, and then he opened his mind to the ebb and flow of energy around them. He listened to the thoughts of the mice in the grass and the worms in the earth and the birds that fluttered past overhead. It was a slightly risky thing to do, for he could end up alerting any nearby enemy spellcasters to their presence. But he preferred to know who and what was close, so that no one could attack them by surprise. Thus he sensed the approach of Arya, Blodgarm, and Queen Islanzadi, and he was not alarmed when the shadows of their footsteps moved toward him from around the western side of the hill. The air rippled like water, and then the three elves appeared before him. Queen Islanzadi stood in the lead, as regal as ever. She was garbed in a golden corselet of scale armour, with a jewelled helm upon her head, and her red, white-trimmed cape clasped about her shoulders. A long, slim sword hung from her narrow waist. She carried a tall, white-bladed spear in one hand, and a shield shaped like a birch leaf, its edges were even serrated like a leaf, in the other. Arya, too, was clad in fine armour. She had exchanged her usual dark clothes for a corselet like her mother's, although Arya's was the grey of bare steel, not gold, and she wore a helm decorated with embossed knotwork upon the brow and nosepiece, and a pair of stylized eagle wings that swept back from her temples. Compared with the splendour of Islanzadi's raiment, Arya's was sombre, but all the more deadly because of it. Together, mother and daughter were like a pair of matched blades, where one was adorned for display and one fitted for combat. Like the two women, Blodgarm wore a shirt of scale armour, but his head was bare, and he carried no weapon besides a small knife on his belt. "Show yourself, Aragorn Shadeslayer," said Islanzadi, looking toward the spot where he stood. Aragorn released the spell that concealed him and Sephira, then bowed to the Elf Queen. She ran her dark eyes over him, studying him as if he were a prize draft horse. Unlike before, he had no difficulty holding her gaze. After a few seconds, the Queen said, "You have improved, Shadeslayer." He gave a second, shorter bow. "Thank you, Your Majesty." As always, the sound of her voice sent a thrill through him. It seemed to hum with magic and music, as if every word were part of an epic poem. "Such a compliment means much from one so wise and fair as you." Islanzadi laughed, showing her long teeth, and the hill and the fields rang with her mirth. "And you have grown eloquent as well. You did not tell me he had become so well-spoken, Arya." A faint smile touched Arya's face. "He is still learning." Then to Aragorn she said, "It is good to see you safely returned." The elves plied him, Saphira, and Gleda with numerous questions, but the three of them refused to provide answers until the others had arrived. Still, Aragorn thought that the elves sensed something of the Eldunari, for he noticed that they sometimes glanced in the direction of the Heart of Hearts, although they seemed not to realize it. Oric was the next to join them. He rode from the south on a shaggy pony that was lathered and panting.
"Ho, Aragorn! Ho, Saphira!" the Dwarf King cried, raising a fist.
He slid down from his exhausted mount, stomped over, and pulled Aragorn into a rough embrace, pounding him on the back. When they had finished greeting each other, and Oric had given Saphira a rub on her nose, which made her hum, Aragorn asked, "Where are your guards?" Oric gestured over his shoulder.
"Braiding their beards by a farmhouse a mile west of here, and none too happy about it, I dare say. I trust every last one of them. They're clanmates of mine. But Blodgarm said I should best come alone, so alone I've come. Now tell me, why this secrecy? What did you discover on Vroengard?"
"You'll have to wait for the rest of our council to find out," said Aragorn. "But I am glad to see you again." And he clapped Oric on the shoulder. Roran arrived on foot soon afterward, looking grim and dusty. He gripped Aragorn's arm and welcomed him, then pulled him aside and said, "Can you stop them from hearing us?" He motioned with his chin toward Oric and the elves. It took Aragorn only a few seconds to cast a spell that shielded them from listeners. "Done." At the same time, he separated his mind from Gleda and the other Eldunari, although not from Saphira. Roran nodded and looked off over the fields. "I had some words with King Orin while you were gone."
"Words? How so?"
"He was being a fool and I told him so."
"I take it he didn't react very kindly."
"You could say that."
"He tried to stab me."
"He what?"
"I managed to knock his sword out of his hand before he could land a blow, but if he had had his way, he would have killed me."
"Orin?"
Aragorn had trouble imagining the king doing any such thing.
"Did you hurt him badly?"
For the first time, Roran smiled, a brief expression that quickly vanished under his beard.
"I scared him, which might be worse."
Aragorn grunted and clenched the pommel of Brisinga. He realized that he and Roran were mirroring each other's posture. They both had their hands on their weapons, and they both stood with their weight on the opposite leg.
"Who else knows of this?"
"Jormunda, he was there, and whomever Orin has told." Frowning, Aragorn began to pace back and forth as he tried to decide what to do.
"The timing of this couldn't be worse."
"I know.
I wouldn't have been so blunt with Orin, but he was about to send royal greetings to Galbatorix and other such nonsense. It would have put us all in danger. I couldn't allow that to happen."
"You would have done the same."
"Maybe so. But this just makes things all the more difficult. I'm the leader of the Varden now. An attack on you or any of the other warriors under my command is the same as an attack on me. Orin knows that, and he knows we're of the same blood. He might as well have thrown a gauntlet in my face."
"He was drunk," said Roran. "I'm not sure he was thinking of that when he drew his sword." Aragorn saw Arya and Blodgarm giving him curious glances. He stopped pacing and turned his back to them.
"I'm worried about Katrina," Roran added. "If Orin is angry enough, he might send his men after me or her. Either way, she could get hurt. Jormunda has already posted a guard at our tent, but that's not enough protection."
Aragorn shook his head.
"Orin wouldn't dare hurt her."
"No,
he can't harm you, and he doesn't have the stomach to confront me directly. So what does that leave?" "An ambush. Knives in the dark. Killing Katrina would be an easy way for Orin to have his revenge."
"I doubt that Orin would resort to knives in the dark or harming Katrina."
"You can't say for sure, though."
Aragorn thought for a moment.
I'll place some spells on Katrina to keep her safe, and I'll let Orin know that I've placed them. That should put a stop to any plans he might have. The tension in Roran seemed to drain away. I'd appreciate that. I'll give you some new wards as well. No, save your strength. I can take care of myself. Aragorn insisted, but Roran kept refusing. Finally, Aragorn said, Blast it, listen to me! We're about to go into battle against Galbatorix's men. You have to have some protection, if only against magic. I'm going to give you wards whether you like it or not, so you might as well smile and thank me for them. Roran glowered at him, then he grunted and raised his hands. Fine. As you wish. You never did know when it was sensible to give up. Oh, and you do? A chuckle came from within the depths of Roran's beard. I suppose not. I guess it runs in the family. Between Brom and Garrow, I don't know who was the more stubborn. Father was, said Roran. Brom was as... No, you're right. It was Garrow. They exchanged grins, remembering their life on the farm. Then Roran shifted his stance and gave Aragorn an odd, sideways look. You seem different than before. Do I? Yes, you do. You seem more sure of yourself. Perhaps it's because I understand myself better than I once did. To that, Roran had no answer. Half an hour later, Jormungandr and King Orin rode up together. Aragorn greeted Orin as politely as ever, but Orin responded with a curt reply and avoided his gaze. Even from a distance of several feet, Aragorn could smell wine on his breath. Once they were all assembled before Saphira, Aragorn began. First he had everyone swear oaths of secrecy in the ancient language. Then he explained the concept of an Eldunari to Oric, Roran, Jormungandr, and Orin. And he recounted a brief history of the dragon's gem-like hearts with the riders and Galbatorix. The elves appeared uneasy with Aragorn's willingness to discuss the Eldunari before the others, but none protested, which pleased him. He had earned that much trust, at least. Oric, Roran, and Jormungandr reacted with surprise, disbelief, and dozens of questions. Roran, in particular, acquired a sharp gleam in his eye, as if the information had given him a host of new ideas on how to kill Galbatorix. Throughout, Orin was surly, and remained stridently unconvinced of the existence of the Eldunari. In the end, the only thing that quelled his doubts was when Aragorn removed Glaider's Heart of Hearts from the saddlebags and introduced the dragon to the four of them. The awe they displayed at meeting Glaider gratified Aragorn. Even Orin seemed impressed, although after exchanging a few words with Glaider, he turned on Aragorn and said, Did Nasawada know of this? Yes, I told her at Feinster. As Aragorn expected, the admission displeased Orin. So once again, the two of you chose to ignore me. Without the support of my men and the food of my nation, the Varden would have had no hope of confronting the Empire. I am the sovereign ruler of one of only four countries in Alagasia. My army makes up a goodly portion of our forces, and yet neither of you deemed it appropriate to inform me of this. Before Aragorn could respond, Oric stepped forward.
They did not tell me about it either, Orin, the dwarf king rumbled. And mine people have helped the Varden for longer than yours. You should not take offense. Aragorn and Nasawada did what they thought was best for our cause. They meant no disrespect.
Orin scowled and looked as if he was going to continue arguing. But Glaider preempted him by saying,
They did as I asked, King of the Sudans. The Eldunari are the greatest secret of our race, and we do not share it lightly with others, even kings.
Then why have you chosen to do so now? Demanded Orin. You could have gone into battle without ever revealing yourself.
In answer, Aragorn recounted the story of their trip to Vroengard, including their encounter with the storm at sea, and the sight they had witnessed at the very top of the clouds. Arya and Blodgam seemed the most interested in that part of his story, whereas Oryk was the most uncomfortable.
"Bazul! But that sounds a nasty experience,"
he said.
"It makes me shiver just to think of it. The ground is the proper place for a dwarf, not the sky."
"I agree,"
said Saphira, which caused Oryk to scowl suspiciously and twist the braided ends of his beard. Resuming his tale, Aragorn told of how he, Saphira, and Glaedha had entered the Vault of Souls, though he refrained from divulging that this had required their true names. And when he at last revealed what the vault had contained, there was a moment of shocked silence. Then Aragorn said, "Open your minds." A moment later, the sound of whispering voices seemed to fill the air, and Aragorn felt the presence of Umaroth and the other hidden dragons surround them. The elves staggered, and Arya dropped to one knee, pressing a hand to the side of her head as if she had been struck. Oryk uttered a cry and looked about wild-eyed, while Roran, Jormunda, and Orin stood dumbfounded. Queen Islanzadi knelt, adopting a pose much like her daughter's. In his mind, Aragorn heard her speaking to the dragons, greeting many by name, and welcoming them as old friends. Blodgam did likewise, and for several minutes a flurry of thoughts passed between the dragons and those gathered at the base of the hill. The mental cacophony was so great, Aragorn shielded himself from it and retreated to sit on one of Saphira's forelegs while he waited for the noise to subside. The elves seemed most affected by the revelation. Blodgam stared into the air with an expression of joy and wonder, while Arya continued to kneel. Aragorn thought he saw a line of tears on each of her cheeks. Islanzadi beamed with a triumphant radiance, and for the first time since he had met her, Aragorn thought she seemed truly happy. Oryk shook himself then and broke from his reverie. Looking over at Aragorn, he said,
"By Morgothal's hammer, this puts a new twist on things. With their help, we might actually be able to kill Galbatorix."
"You didn't think we could before?" Aragorn asked mildly.
"Of course I did, only not so much as I do now."
Roran shook himself as if waking from a dream. I knew that you and the elves would fight as hard as you could, but I didn't believe you could win." He met Aragorn's gaze. "Galbatorix has defeated so many riders, and you're but one, and not that old. It didn't seem possible."
"I know.
Now, though,"
a wolfish look came into Roran's eyes,
"now we have a chance."
"Aye," said Jormunda, "and just think, we no longer have to worry so much about Murtagh. He's no match for you and the dragons combined."
Aragorn drummed his heels against Saphira's leg and did not answer. He had other ideas on that front. Besides, he did not like to consider having to kill Murtagh. Then Orin spoke up.
"Umaroth says that you have devised a battle plan. Do you intend to share it with us, Shadeslayer?"
"I would like to hear it as well," said Islanzadi in a kinder tone.
"And I,"
said Oryk. Aragorn stared at them for a moment, then nodded. To Islanzadi, he said, "Is your army ready to fight?"
"It is. Long have we waited for our vengeance. We need wait no longer."
"And ours?" Aragorn asked, directing his words toward Orin, Jormunda, and Oryk.
"Mine Nerlin are eager for battle,"
proclaimed Oryk. Jormunda glanced at King Orin.
"Our men are tired and hungry, but their will is unbroken."
"The Urgals too?"
"Them too."
"Then we attack."
"When?"
demanded Orin.
"At first light."
For a moment, no one spoke. Roran broke the silence.
"Easy to say, hard to do."
"How?"
Aragorn explained. When he finished, there was another silence. Roran squatted and began to draw in the dirt with the tip of a finger.
It's risky, but bold, said Oric. Very bold.
There are no safe paths anymore, said Aragorn. If we can catch Galbatorix unprepared, even a bit, it might be enough to tip the scales.
Jormungandr rubbed his chin.
Why not kill Murtagh first? That's the part I don't understand. Why not finish him and Thorne while we have the chance?
Because, Aragorn replied, then Galbatorix would know of them.
And he motioned toward where the hidden Eldunari floated.
We would lose the advantage of surprise.
What of the child? Orin asked harshly. What makes you think that she will accommodate you? She hasn't before.
This time she will, Aragorn promised, more confidently than he felt.
The king grunted, unconvinced. Then Islanzadi said,
Aragorn, it is a great and terrible thing you propose. Are you willing to do this? I ask not because I doubt your dedication or your bravery, but because this is something to be undertaken only after much consideration. So I ask you, are you willing to do this, even knowing what the cost may be?
Aragorn did not rise, but he allowed a bit of steel to enter his voice.
I am. It must be done, and we are the ones to whom the task has fallen. Whatever the cost, we cannot turn away now.
As a sign of her agreement, Saphira opened her jaws a few inches and then snapped them shut, punctuating the end of his sentence.
Islanzadi turned her face toward the sky. And do you and those you speak for approve of this, Umaroth Elder?
We do,
replied the white dragon.
Then here we go, Roran murmured.
A matter of duty. The ten of them, including Umaroth, continued to talk for another hour. Orin required more convincing, and there were numerous details to decide. Questions of timing and placement and signalling.
Aragorn was relieved when Arya said, Unless either you or Saphira object, I will accompany you tomorrow. We would be glad to have you, he said.
Islanzadi stiffened.
What good would that accomplish? Your talents are needed elsewhere, Arya. Blodgarm and the other spellcasters I assigned to Saphira and Aragorn are more skilled at magic than you, and more experienced in battle as well. Remember they fought against the Forsworn, and unlike many, they lived to tell of it. Many of the elder members of our race would volunteer to take your place. It would be selfish to insist upon going when there are others better suited for the task who are willing and close at hand. I think no one is as suited for the task as Arya, Aragorn said in a calm voice. And there is no one other than Saphira I would rather have by my side.
Islanzadi kept her gaze upon Arya and to Aragorn said,
You are still young, Shadeslayer, and you are allowing your emotions to cloud your judgment. No, Mother, said Arya. It is you who are allowing your emotions to cloud your judgment.
She moved toward Islanzadi with long, graceful steps.
You are right. There are others who are stronger, wiser, and more experienced than I. But it was I who ferried Saphira's egg about Alagazia, I who helped save Aragorn from the Shade Durza. And I, who with Aragorn's help, killed the Shade Varrog in Feinster. Like Aragorn, I am now a Shadeslayer, and you well know that I swore myself in service to our people long ago. Who else among our kind can claim as much? Even if I wanted to, I would not turn away from this. I would sooner die. I am as prepared for this challenge as any of our elders. For it is to this I have devoted the whole of my life, as has Aragorn. And the whole of your life has been so short, said Islanzadi. She put a hand up to Arya's face. You have devoted yourself to fighting Galbatorix all these years.
since your father's death. But you know little of the joys life can provide, and in those years we have spent such a small amount of time together. A handful of days scattered throughout a century. It is only since you brought Saphira and Eragon to Ellesmira that we have begun to speak once more, as a mother and daughter ought. I would not lose you again so soon, Arya. It was not I who chose to remain apart, said Arya. No, said Islandzadi, and she took her hand away. But it was you who chose to leave De Weldenvarden. Her expression softened. I do not wish to argue, Arya. I understand that you see this as your duty. But please, for my sake, will you not allow another to take your place? Arya lowered her gaze and was silent for a time. Then she said, I cannot allow Eragon and Saphira to go without me, any more than you can allow your army to march into battle without you at its head. I cannot. Would you have it said of me that I am a coward? Those of our family do not turn away from what must be done. Do not ask me to shame myself. The shine in Islandzadi's eyes looked suspiciously like tears to Eragon. Yes, said the queen, but to fight Galbatorix. If you are so afraid, said Arya, but not unkindly, then come with me. I cannot. I must stay to command my troops, and I must go with Eragon and Saphira. But I promise you, I shall not die. Arya placed her hand on Islandzadi's face, even as her mother had done to her. I shall not die. Once more, Arya repeated the phrase, but this time in the ancient language. Arya's determination impressed Eragon. To say what she had in the ancient language meant that she believed it without qualification. Islandzadi also appeared impressed, and proud too. She smiled and kissed Arya once on each cheek. Then go, and go with my blessings, and take no more risks than you must, nor you. And the two of them embraced. As they separated, Islandzadi looked at Eragon and Saphira and said, Watch over her, I implore you, for she has not a dragon or the Eldunari to protect her. We will, both Eragon and Saphira replied in the ancient language. Once they had settled what needed to be settled, the war council broke, and its various members began to disperse. From where he sat by Saphira, Eragon watched the others mill about. Neither he nor she made an effort to move. Saphira was going to remain hidden behind the hill until the attack, while he intended to wait for dark before he ventured into the camp. Oryk was the second to depart after Roran. Before he did, the Dwarf King came over to Eragon and gave him a rough hug.
Ah, I wish I were going with the two of you, he said, his eyes solemn above his beard.
And I wish you were coming, said Eragon.
Well, we'll see each other afterward, and toast our victory with barrels of mead, eh?
I look forward to it.
As do I, said Saphira.
Good,
said Oryk, and he nodded firmly.
That's settled, then. You'd better not let Galbatorix get the better of you, or I'll be honour-bound to march in after you.
We'll be careful, Eragon said with a smile.
I should hope so, because I doubt I could do much more than tweak Galbatorix on the nose.
That I would like to see, said Saphira.
Oryk grunted.
May the gods watch over you, Eragon. And you as well, Saphira.
And you, Oryk, Thrift's son. Then Oryk slapped Eragon on the shoulder and stomped off to where he had tied his pony to a bush. When Islandzadi and Blodgarm left, Arya stayed. She was deep in conversation with Jormunda, and so Eragon thought little of it. When Jormunda rode off, however, and Arya still lingered nearby, he realized that she wanted to talk to them alone. Sure enough, once everyone else had gone, she looked at him and Saphira
and said, "Did something else happen to you while you were gone? Something that you didn't want to speak of in front of Orin or Jormunda? Or my mother? Why do you ask?" She hesitated. "Because you both seem to have changed. Is it the Eldunari? Or does it have to do with your experience in the storm?"
Aragorn smiled at her perception. He consulted with Saphira, and when she approved, he said,
"We learned our true names."
Arya's eyes widened.
"You did? And were you pleased with them?"
"In part,"
said Saphira.
"We learned our true names," Aragorn repeated. "We saw that the earth is round, and during the flight here, Umaroth and the other Eldunari shared many of their memories with us."
He allowed himself a wry smile.
"I can't say we understand all of them, but they make things seem different."
"I see," murmured Arya. "Do you think the change is for the better?"
"I do. Change itself is neither good nor bad, but knowledge is always useful. Was it difficult to find your true names?"
So he told her how they had accomplished it, and he also told her about the strange creatures they had encountered on Vroengard Island, which interested her greatly. As Aragorn spoke, an idea occurred to him, one that resonated within him too strongly to ignore. He explained it to Saphira, and once again she granted him her permission, although somewhat more reluctantly than before.
"Must you?"
she asked.
"Yes."
"Then do as you will, but only if she agrees."
When they had finished speaking of Vroengard, he looked Arya in the eyes and said,
"Would you like to hear my true name? I would like to share it with you."
The offer seemed to shock her.
"No, you shouldn't tell it to me or anyone else, especially not when we're so close to Galbatorix. He might steal it from my mind. Besides, you should only give your true name to one whom you trust above all others."
"I trust you,
Aragorn. Even when we elves exchange our true names, we do not do so until we have known each other for many, many years. The knowledge they provide is too personal, too intimate, to bandy about. And there is no greater risk than sharing it. When you teach someone your true name, you place everything you are in their hands."
"I know, but I may never have the chance again. This is the only thing I have to give,
and I would give it to you. Aragorn, what you are proposing, it is the most precious thing one person can give another."
"I know." A shiver ran through Arya, and then she seemed to withdraw within herself. After a time, she said,
"No one has ever offered me such a gift before. I'm honored by your trust, Aragorn, and I understand how much this means to you. But no, I must decline. It would be wrong for you to do this, and wrong for me to accept, just because tomorrow we may be killed or enslaved. Danger is no reason to act foolishly, no matter how great our peril."
Aragorn inclined his head. Her reasons were good reasons, and he would respect her choice.
"Very well, as you wish," he said. "Thank you, Aragorn."
A moment passed. Then he said,
"Have you ever told anyone your true name?"
"No."
"Not even your mother?"
Her mouth twisted.
"No."
"Do you know what it is?"
"Of course. Why would you think otherwise?"
He half shrugged.
"I didn't. I just wasn't sure."
Silence came between them. Then,
How did you learn your true name?"
Arya was quiet for so long, he began to think that she would refuse to answer. Then she took a breath and said,
"It was a number of years after I left Duweldenvarden, when I finally had become accustomed to my role among the Varden and the dwarves. Faelan and my other companions were away, and I had a great deal of time to myself. I spent most of it exploring Trondheim, wandering in the empty reaches of the city mountain, where others rarely tread. Trondheim is bigger than most realize, and there are many strange things within it. Rooms, people, creatures, forgotten artifacts. As I wandered, I thought, and I came to know myself better than ever I had before. One day, I discovered a room somewhere high in Trondheim. I doubt I could locate it again, even if I tried. A beam of sunlight seemed to pour into the room, though the ceiling was solid, and in the center of the room was a pedestal, and upon the pedestal was growing a single flower. I do not know what kind of flower it was. I have never seen its like before or since. The petals were purple, but the center of the blossom was like a drop of blood. There were thorns upon the stem, and the flower exuded the most wonderful scent and seemed to hum with a music all its own. It was such an amazing and unlikely thing to find. I stayed in the room, staring at the flower for longer than I can remember, and it was then and there that I was finally able to put words to who I was and who I am. I would like to see that flower some day. Perhaps you will.
Arya glanced toward the Varden's camp.
I should go. There is much yet to be done.
He nodded. We'll see you tomorrow, then.
Tomorrow.
Arya began to walk away. After a few steps, she paused and looked back.
I'm glad that Saphira chose you as her rider, Aragorn, and I'm proud to have fought alongside you. You have become more than any of us dared hope. Whatever happens tomorrow, know that.
Then she resumed her stride, and soon she disappeared around the curve of the hill, leaving him alone with Saphira and the Aldunari. Fire in the Night. When darkness fell, Aragorn cast a spell to hide himself. Then he patted Saphira on the nose and set out on foot for the Varden's camp.
Be careful, she said.
Invisible as he was, it was easy to slip past the warriors who kept watch around the periphery of the camp. As long as he was quiet, and as long as the men did not catch sight of his footprints or shadows, he could move about freely. He wound his way between the woolen tents until he found Roran and Katrina's. He rapped his knuckles against the central pole, and Roran popped his head out.
Where are you? Whispered Roran. Hurry in!
Releasing the flow of magic, Aragorn revealed himself. Roran flinched, then grabbed him by the arm and pulled him into the dark interior of the tent.
Welcome, Aragorn, said Katrina, rising from where she sat on their tiny cot. Katrina, it's good to see you again. She gave him a quick embrace.
Will this take long?
Roran asked. Aragorn shook his head.
It shouldn't.
Squatting on his heels, he thought for a moment, then began to chant softly in the ancient language. First, he placed spells around Katrina to protect her against any who might harm her. He made the spells more extensive than he had originally planned, in an attempt to ensure that she and her unborn child would be able to escape Galbatorix's forces should something happen to both him and Roran. These wards will shield you from a certain number of attacks, he told her. I can't tell you how many exactly, because it depends on the strength of the blows or spells. I've given you another defense as well. If you're in danger, say the word Frethia 2 times, and you'll vanish from sight.
Frethia, she murmured.
Exactly.
It won't hide you completely, however. The sounds you make can still be heard, and your footprints will still be visible. No matter what happens, don't go into water, or your position will be obvious at once. The spell will draw its energy from you, which means that you'll tire faster than usual, and I wouldn't recommend sleeping while it's active. You might not wake up again. To end the spell, simply say, Frethia letter.
Frethia letter.
Good.
Then Aragorn turned his attention to Roran. He spent longer placing the wards around his cousin, for it was likely Roran would confront a greater number of threats. And he endowed the spells with more energy than he thought Roran would have approved of, but Aragorn did not care.
He could not bear the thought of defeating Galbatorix, only to find that Roran had died during the battle. Afterward, he said, "I did something different this time, something I should have thought of long ago. In addition to the usual wards, I gave you a few that will feed directly off your own strength. As long as you're alive, they'll shield you from danger. But," he lifted a finger, "they'll only activate once the other wards are exhausted. And if the demands placed upon them are too great, you'll fall unconscious and then you'll die." "So in trying to save me, they may kill me?" Roran asked. Aragorn nodded. "Don't let anyone drop another wall on you and you'll be fine. It's a risk, but worth it, I think, if it keeps a horse from trampling you or a javelin from going through you. Also, I gave you the same spell as Katrina. All you have to do is say Frethia twice and Frethia letter to turn yourself invisible and visible at will." He shrugged. "You might find that useful during the battle." Roran gave an evil chuckle. "That I will. Just make sure the elves don't mistake you for one of Galbatorix's spellcasters." As Aragorn rose to his feet, Katrina stood as well. She surprised him by grasping one of his hands and pressing it against her chest. "Thank you, Aragorn," she said softly. "You're a good man." He flushed, embarrassed. "It's nothing. Guard yourself well tomorrow. You mean a great deal to both of us, and I expect you to be around to act the doting uncle for our child. I'll be most put out if you get yourself killed." He laughed. "Don't worry. Saphira won't let me do anything foolish." "Good." She kissed him on both cheeks, then released him. "Farewell, Katrina." Roran accompanied him outside. Motioning toward the tent, Roran said, "Thank you. I'm glad I could help." They gripped each other by the forearms and hugged. Then Roran said, "Luck be with you." Aragorn took a long, unsteady breath. "Luck be with you." He tightened his grip on Roran's forearm, reluctant to let go, for he knew that they might never meet again. "If Saphira and I don't come back," he said, "will you see to it that we're buried at home? I wouldn't want our bones to lie here." Roran raised his brows. "Saphira would be difficult to lug all the way back." "The elves would help, I'm sure." "Then yes, I promise. Is there anywhere in particular you would like?" "The top of the Bald Hill," said Aragorn, referring to a foothill near their farm. The bare-topped hill had always seemed like an excellent location for a castle, something they had discussed at great length when younger. Roran nodded. "And if I don't come back, we'll do the same for you. That's not what I was going to ask. If I don't, you'll see to Katrina?" "Of course, you know that." "Aye, but I had to be sure." They gazed at each other for another minute. Finally, Roran said, "We'll be expecting you for dinner tomorrow." "I'll be there." Then Roran slipped back into the tent, leaving Aragorn standing alone in the night. He looked up at the stars and felt a touch of grief, as if he had already lost someone close to him. After a few moments, he padded away into the shadows, relying upon the darkness to conceal him. He searched through the camp until he found the tent Horst and Elaine shared with their baby girl, Hope. The three of them were still awake, as the infant was crying.
"Aragorn," Horst exclaimed softly, when Aragorn made his presence known. "Come in, come in. We haven't seen much of you since Dras Leona. How are you?"
Aragorn spent the better part of an hour talking with them. He did not tell them of the Eldunari, but he did tell them of his trip to Vroengard. And when Hope finally fell asleep, he bade them farewell and returned to the night. He next sought out Jod, whom he found reading scrolls by candlelight while his wife, Helen, slept. When Aragorn knocked and stuck his face into the tent, the scarred, thin-faced man put aside his scrolls and left the tent to join Aragorn. Jod had many questions, and while Aragorn did not answer them all, he answered enough that he thought Jod would be able to guess much of what was about to happen. Afterward, Jod laid a hand on Aragorn's shoulder.
"I don't envy you the task that lies ahead. Brom would be proud of your courage."
"I hope so."
"I'm sure of it. If I don't see you again, you should know I've written a small account of your experiences and of the events that led to them, mainly my adventures with Brom in recovering Saphira's egg.
Aragorn gave him a look of surprise.
I may not get the opportunity to finish it, but I thought it would make a useful addition to Heslant's work in Domia Aberwyrda.
Aragorn laughed.
I think that would be most fitting. However, if you and I are both alive and free after tomorrow, there are some things I should tell you which will make your account that much more complete and that much more interesting. I'll hold you to it.
Aragorn wandered through the camp for another hour or so, pausing by the fires where men, dwarves, and Urgals still sat awake. He spoke briefly with each of the warriors he met, inquired whether they were being fairly treated, commiserated about their sore feet and short rations, and sometimes exchanged a quip or two. He hoped that by showing himself among them, he could lift the warriors' spirits and strengthen their resolve, and thus spread a sense of optimism throughout the army. The Urgals, he found, were in the best mood. They seemed delighted about the upcoming battle and the opportunities for glory that it would provide. He had another purpose as well, to spread false information. Whenever someone asked him about attacking Urubane, he hinted that he and Saphira would be among the battalion to besiege the northwestern section of the city wall. He hoped that Galbatorix's spies would repeat the lie to the king as soon as the alarms woke Galbatorix the following morn. As he looked into the faces of those listening to him, Aragorn could not help but wonder which, if any, were Galbatorix's servants. The thought made him uncomfortable, and he found himself listening for footsteps behind him when he moved from one fire to the next. At last, when he was satisfied that he had spoken to enough warriors to ensure that the information would reach Galbatorix, he left the fires behind and made his way to a tent that was set slightly away from the others, by the southern edge of the camp. He knocked on the center pole, once, twice, three times. There was no response, so he knocked again, this time louder and longer. A moment later, he heard a sleepy groan and the rustle of shifting blankets. He waited patiently until a small hand pulled aside the entrance flap, and the witch-child Elva emerged. She wore a dark robe much too large for her, and by the faint light of a torch some yards away, he could see a frown upon her sharp little face. "What do you want, Aragorn?" she demanded. "Can't you tell?" Her frown deepened. "No, I can't. Only that you want something badly enough to wake me in the middle of the night, which even an idiot could see. What is it? I get little enough rest as it is, so this had best be important."
"It is." He spoke without interruption for several minutes, describing his plan, then said, "Without you, it won't work. You're the point upon which it all turns."
She gave an ugly laugh.
"Such irony. The mighty warrior relying upon a child to kill the one he cannot.
Will you help?"
The girl looked down and scuffed her bare foot against the ground.
"If you do, all this,"
he motioned toward the camp and the city beyond,
"may end far sooner, and then you will not have to endure quite so much."
"I'll help." She stamped her foot and glared at him. "You don't have to bribe me. I was going to help anyway. I'm not about to let Galbatorix destroy the Varden just because I don't like you. You're not that important, Aragorn. Besides, I made a promise to Nasawada, and I intend to keep it." She cocked her head. "There's something you're not telling me. Something you're afraid Galbatorix will find out before the attack. Something about..."
The sound of clanking chains interrupted her. For a moment, Aragorn was confused. Then he realized the sound was coming from the city. He put his hand on his sword. "Ready yourself," he said to Elva. "We may have to leave at once." Without argument, the girl turned around and disappeared inside the tent. Reaching out with his mind, Aragorn contacted Saphira.
"Do you hear it?"
"Yes."
"If we have to,
We'll meet you by the road. The clanking continued for a short while. Then there was a hollow boom, followed by silence. Aragorn listened as intently as he could, but heard nothing more. He was just about to cast a spell to increase the sensitivity of his ears, when there was a dull thud, accompanied by a series of sharp clacks. Then another, and another. A shiver of horror ran down Aragorn's spine. The sound was unmistakably that of a dragon walking on stone. But what a dragon, to hear its steps from over a mile away! Shrooken, he thought, and his gut clenched with dread. Throughout the camp, alarm horns blared, and men, dwarves, and Urgals lit torches as the army scrambled to wakefulness. Aragorn spared Elva a sideways glance as she hurried out of the tent, followed by Greta, the old woman who was her caretaker. The girl had donned a short red tunic, over which she wore a male hauberk just her size. The footsteps in Urabain ceased. The dragon's shadowy bulk blotted out most of the lanterns and watchlights in the city. "How big is he?" Aragorn wondered, dismayed. Bigger than Gleda, that was certain. As big as Belgabad? Aragorn could not tell, not yet. Then the dragon leaped up and out from the city, and he unfurled his massive wings, and their opening was like 100 black sails filling with wind. When he flapped, the air shook as if from a clap of thunder, and throughout the countryside, dogs bayed and roosters crowed. Without thinking, Aragorn crouched, feeling like a mouse hiding from an eagle. Elva tugged on the hem of his tunic.
"We should go," she insisted.
"Wait," he whispered. "Not yet." Great swathes of stars vanished as Shrooken wheeled across the sky, climbing higher and higher. Aragorn tried to guess the dragon's size from the outline of his shape, but the night was too dark and the distance too hard to determine. Whatever Shrooken's exact proportions, he was frighteningly large. At only a century of age, he ought to have been smaller than he was, but Galbatorix seemed to have accelerated his growth, even as he had thorns. As he watched the shadow drifting above, Aragorn hoped with all his might that Galbatorix was not with the dragon, or if he was, that he would not bother to examine the minds of those below. If he did, he would discover...
"Eldunari," gasped Elva. "That's what you're hiding."
Behind her, the girl's caretaker frowned with puzzlement and started to ask a question.
"Quiet," growled Aragorn.
Elva opened her mouth, and he clamped his hand over it, silencing her.
"Not here, not now," he warned.
She nodded, and he removed his hand. At that very moment, a bar of fire as wide as the Anora River arced across the sky. Shrooken whipped his head back and forth, spraying the torrent of blinding flames above the camp and the surrounding fields, and the night filled with a sound like a crashing waterfall. Heat stung Aragorn's upturned face. Then the flames evaporated like mist in the sun, leaving behind a throbbing afterimage and a smoky, sulphurous smell. The huge dragon turned and flapped once more, shaking the air, before his formless black shape glided back down toward the city and settled among the buildings. Footsteps followed, then the clanking of the chains, and finally the echoing crack of a gate slamming shut. Aragorn released the breath he had been holding and swallowed, though his throat was dry. His heart was pounding so hard it was painful. "We have to fight that?" he thought, all his old fears rushing back.
"Why didn't he attack?"
asked Elva in a small, fearful voice.
"He wanted to frighten us," Aragorn frowned.
"Or distract us." He searched through the mines of the Varden until he found Jormungandr, then gave the warrior instructions to check that all the sentries were still at their posts and to redouble the watch for the remainder of the night. To Elva, he said, "Were you able to feel anything from Shrooken?" The girl shuddered.
"Pain. Great pain. And anger, too. If he could, he would kill every creature he met,
and burn every plant until there were none left. He's utterly mad.
Is there no way to reach him?
None. The kindest thing to do would be to release him from his misery.
The knowledge made Aragorn sad. He had always hoped that they might be able to save Shrukan from Galbatorix. Subdued, he said, "We had best be off. Are you ready?"
Elva explained to her caretaker that she was leaving, which displeased the old woman, but Elva soothed her worries with a few quick words. The girl's power to see into others' hearts never ceased to amaze Aragorn, and trouble him as well. Once Greta had granted her consent, Aragorn hid both Elva and himself with magic, and then they set off together toward the hill where Saphira was waiting.